Jeremy, what happens when you turn 40?
Well, I'm not going to get wrinkles because I'm using collagen.
And your TheraFace thing that makes your face like a baby's butt.
Yeah, if I can go on a quick tangent for a second. We don't always record in the mornings. And when we do, I just need to give you an example of what I did this morning.
Oh, goodness.
I had a certain greens powder because
I ordered it
for our podcast.
Yes.
And I need to get rid of it. So I had that. And did it happen to have scoops of collagen in it because I had that for our podcast and need to get rid of it? Yes. And mm-hmm. then did I cold plunge? Yes. And then did I do yoga? Yes. So I've come to the conclusion of two things. One, I'm going to live forever. And two, I need help.
Yeah, I think Peter...
So yeah, I'm very happy because I feel like you're about to do a non-wellness topic.
Yeah. Yeah, we're going to hard pivot. Well, it is a wellness topic, and I think it's going to be... hopefully giving very actionable items to our listeners about how they can protect themselves in a very real, very tangible way. I love that.
I didn't answer your question. When I turn 40, I think I start to worry that I'm going to die.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, I do that every day. It's just called your daily morning existential crisis, right? Well, what happens when you turn 40 and you also have boobs?
That I cannot answer.
Well, you could answer as a physician.
Sure. Well, it seems like you probably should. Well, I don't know. My perception is that if you have boobs, you're always worried you're going to have breast cancer, whether you're 40 or not.
Right.
But I'm thinking you're leading me towards that.
Okay. Yeah, I absolutely am. Well, since May of 2023, the USPSTF, so the United States Preventative Services Task Force, which is where we get our kind of overarching recommendations and then how our healthcare system then follows suit by, like, hopefully covering things by our insurance plans, that kind of stuff. They have recommended that women at average risk for breast cancer start screening with mammograms beginning at age 40. So that, like, blanket recommendation kind of just happened within the last year. And then they recommend that they undergo mammography every other year if you are at average risk, which we will talk about. These updated recommendations, if you look at the website for it, are still in progress. There's a giant banner that says in progress. And the USPSTF cites the urgent need for more research in a couple different areas. One, for breast cancer screening for people with dense breasts, which is nearly half of women, especially younger women, and we'll get to that too. And then research on how to particularly protect women of color. And they're citing the U.S.'s long history of health disparities across screening and treatment for breast cancer. The task force discusses, for example, that black women are 40% more likely to die than white women and too often get very aggressive cancers at young ages. So we've got some work to do. So I thought that perhaps I would take a page from America's sweetheart, in my opinion, also consummate badass and breast cancer survivor herself, Katie Couric. But I will not be live streaming my mammogram, as you may remember that Katie both underwent a colonoscopy and a mammogram on the Today Show, but I can do the next best thing. Your doctor friends have the absolute honor to present our guest today, a consummate badass herself, breast cancer survivor and breast surgeon, to walk me through my own personal risk assessment and screening process for breast cancer. And then finally, I would like to take some time at the end of this episode to share the story of a dear friend and colleague, a fellow sports medicine doctor, an absolute amazing human being who very recently lost her life to breast cancer. She is the inspiration for this episode, and I just think it's important to talk about her, and I'm so grateful to her family for their consent for me to share her story today. So, let's get on with it. Can we answer the question, how can I protect myself from breast cancer? Welcome to Your Doctor Friends, the show that teaches you to sniff out the garbage and answers all the questions that you wish you could call or text your doctor friend. My name's Julie Bruni.
And I'm Jeremy Allen, and we are two physicians who work at a nationally ranked practice and take care of some of the world's greatest athletes. We know that you have questions, and we want to help.
We want to be your doctor friends. All right, we are back, and we are delighted to welcome Dr. Liz O'Riordan. Dr. O'Riordan is an expert breast surgeon who has had breast cancer herself three times. She is a best-selling author, speaker, broadcaster, and podcaster, and is a trusted source of reliable information. She shares helpful, approachable, valid breast cancer information online, and we found her via her Instagram account, at O'RiordanLiz. She also has a podcast called So Now I've Got Breast Cancer, and she's published tons of helpful work, including her book, The Complete Guide to Breast Cancer, and her memoir, Under the Knife. She also has her own Wikipedia page, which is, like, so intimidating. So, Dr. O'Riordan, Liz, Thank you so much for being here. We are honored.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's brilliant to be able to talk about this really important topic.
I love it. Well, 100% transparency. I lifted many of the questions I'm going to ask you because you've covered them on your podcast or on your blog or on your Instagram.
They're the questions. They're the questions people ask me every day. Right. I get my content from the questions that people come to me with. So they're worldwide.
Yeah, exactly. So thank you for doing like 90% of the work for my outline today. Even more transparency, again, kind of as I mentioned in the cold open, I'll be framing many of these questions as though I am your patient. I found it sort of personalizes the experience and can make things a bit more concrete for our listeners and for me myself. And, you know, it's like I get a curbside. I'm turning 40 in a couple months, and my primary care provider, Dr. Pitlosh, who I absolutely adore, so shout out to Max, already gave me my mammogram order at my last annual visit, and I've yet to make the appointment, but I'm strangely very much looking forward to it. Mm-hmm. So can you give us like the elevator pitch for the current recommendations for breast cancer screening and risk assessment? I'm not sure if they differ in the UK and the US, but can you give us like our quick overview of what the current recommendations are in your mind?
They do differ in the UK and the US. And okay. In the US, as you said, from the age of 40, if you have an average risk of breast cancer, you should be getting mammograms every other year. In the UK and a lot of European countries, we start from the age of 50 and it's every 3 years. There's so much research and evidence about whether breast screening is effective and the money you have to put in to make it effective. And what the problem we have in the UK is that less than half of all women are going for their first mammogram.
Yeah.
Woof. And this is not just a hangover from COVID. And almost a third of women aren't turning up for their regular mammograms, whether they're scared. It's difficult getting an appointment if you work, but there's still this fear. And there are a lot of people online saying that mammograms don't work. They cause breast cancer themselves. They're dangerous. And it's how we can get rid of all that nonsense out there and just give anyone listening the common sense approach, why we do it, what it involves, do they hurt, are they dangerous, and why they are a really good thing.
Yeah. There's a lot of parallels here that I don't really want to go into because it's talking about the poor uptake of vaccines in many ways in the United States.
And I'm sure same.
Very, very similar, distrust, yeah.
When it comes to breast cancer, we know that the earlier we catch it, the less likely you are to die and the less treatment you're likely to need. And that's not something that comes up in all the stats. But if your cancer is found at a very small size, you're less likely to need a mastectomy, to have your breast removed. You're less likely to need aggressive treatments like chemotherapy.
Wow.
We know that breast cancers start growing from a couple of cells, and it can take 5 or 10 years for them to become a lump that you can feel. What a mammogram can do is pick up tiny microcalcifications when they're a couple of millimeters in size, years before you'd feel it. And that means you can get the breast cancer treated quite quickly and simply, and most women won't need treatments like chemotherapy. The problem is, with the people who say mammograms are bad, that some of those cancers we find at a very early stage will never go on to become a breast cancer because they're so slow growing. And a few women are being overtreated. But if we do find something early, we don't know what to do with it. Do we say, well, you've got pre-breast cancer, DCIS. Do you want a biopsy and a mammogram every year for the rest of your life until you do decide to have something? So that's where a lot of people say it's not worth it. We're overtreating women. But from my point of view, they do save lives. They can reduce the amount of treatment you need. And it's so important that you go for them, as well as carrying on to checking your breasts in between the mammograms.
I love that. Jeremy, wasn't that so smooth? It's like if somebody talked to you in the office and asked you a question about like options for knee arthritis treatment, like it just rolls off of Liz's tongue. It's like watching or listening to a very well-practiced, very trained singer just hit every single note. It's just lovely to hear.
But I'll tell you, I was scared of having mine. So I found a lump, my first lump when I was 40, and I was scared of having it because I've sat in clinics and women have asked me, do they hurt? And I have no idea because I've never had one. I used to say, no, not really, because for most women, they don't. But suddenly you're there and you're stripped off. And you're like, ow. And I'm young and I had dense breasts and it was a painful pinch and it made my eyes water briefly. But it lasts a couple of seconds and then you move on. And it was like, oh, okay, it wasn't as bad as I thought. I built it up to be a lot more scary than it would be.
Yeah.
I definitely get the sense, Liz, that you've been asked these questions before.
Yeah.
So Thank you for being here to share all this information with us. I want to ask you, how do you reconcile the differences between the United States and the UK in those recommendations? Because you get asked this stuff all the time, and those recommendations are 10-year difference. So how do you reconcile those?
So the problem we have, as you said earlier, is that young women tend to have dense breasts. And dense breasts just mean you have a lot of glandular tissue. Your breasts are your boobs are waiting for you to make milk if you have a baby. When you reach the menopause, breasts tend to become less dense because they're less hormonally active. So most women, although not everyone, their breasts become less dense. The mammograms work by spotting a white breast cancer on a black background. And I've got a video on this using white marshmallows and milk and coffee. If I put a white marshmallow in a jug of coffee, you can see it really clearly. And a coffee is a less dense, black, fatty breast. But if you're young and you've got dense breasts, they look white. So that marshmallow is really hard to find. So mammograms aren't as accurate in younger women with dense breasts. And that's why in the UK, to start with, we start from the age of 50, where your breasts get less dense. There are lots of research at the moment looking into what to do for women with dense breasts. Do we do extra ultrasounds or MRIs? They can pick it up. But for screening, to screen a whole population, you have to be able to prove that MRIing everybody reduces the number of women dying of breast cancer. And we don't have that research at the moment, and MRIs and ultrasounds take much longer to do. So we don't know. But I think in the States, you're much more driven by patients demanding, I want this, I want this, I want this. And it's easy to say, well, okay, we'll give them what they want. You guys are often paying for it privately, so we'll give you the mammogram. But my worry is people will assume a normal mammogram means that there isn't any breast cancer there, which is why it's really important to keep checking to reduce your risk factors.
So if I could translate real quick, it seems like what you have less of a problem with is the 40 and more what the testing we have between 40 and 50. So if we had better testing for the denser breast, the earlier age may make sense.
Yes. And it's assuming younger women would go for their screens.
Right.
In the UK, and I think in the States, if you have a high risk, and that means you've got a strong family history, then we do recommend earlier mammograms and MRIs because your risk of getting breast cancer is much higher than a woman like me when I was diagnosed.
I would love to jump off of that right now, Liz, and talk about risks. And I think this is probably where we're going to spend a chunk of our talk. And I'm very bad at asking five questions at once because I get very excited. So I'm going to try real hard. How can people determine their breast cancer risk score? I know you've mentioned there's validated tools online through your videos, and I would love to get your pitch on that.
So breast cancer risk is not a tool I'd ever used or heard of until Olivia Munn was diagnosed.
Yeah.
There is a risk tool. There are two, the Thyrocusic and the Boudicea model, I think, that are used for assessing your family history risk of breast cancer. In the UK, we work off if there's only one person in your family diagnosed over the age of 45, then your risk isn't increased. It's normal. If you have two, three or four members, kind of mother, aunt, sister, quite close to you, diagnosed in their 40s or 50s, your risk starts to go up. And if that happens, then we send you to a geneticist who can use the Thyrocusic risk model to put all your factors in and say, is your genetic risk based on your family history low, average or high? And that will recommend what early screening you need. So that's the risk factor that Olivia Munn did. I assume she had family history members involved. And you can just type in Thyrocusic and find it and put all these factors in online. And that will give you your risk based on your family history. It also uses other small things that have a really tiny impact, but people focus on them. And they're not the biggest risk factors to getting breast cancer, but I'll mention them now. I'll say your biggest risk factors to getting breast cancer are being a woman, so being born with biological breast tissue. Men still get breast cancer, but they have much less breast tissue, so their risk is like 1 in 300 compared to women where it's 1 in 2 by the time you reach the age of 70. The next biggest risk factor is getting old, because cancer is a disease of aging. The longer you live, the more spelling mistakes your genes make as they multiply, the cells divide, the more likely cancer is to happen. Your lifetime exposure for estrogen, we think, is related. So if you have a baby at 16 and 18 and 20 and 23 and 25 and you breastfeed, you are not having regular menstrual cycles for about 10 years. And that gives you less regular estrogen than someone who started their periods at 16, never had children. And these have a very small impact, and often the genetic risk factor scores will take them into account, but their bearing is tiny. And that is not a reason to not have a family or to have a large family to reduce your breast cancer risk.
I love that. Yeah,
that person hasn't slept very well in a while.
No, but I've had women saying, you know, is it my fault I got breast cancer because I had kids when I was 13? No, the risk is tiny. There are three things that have a much bigger impact on your risk that you can control and you should control.
Yeah. I would love to just, and I'll probably try to put them in the categories of which you've just mentioned. And it sounds like you've really given us that answer, but I would love to go through just some of the things that I found. So one, age, it sounds like that is one of the major ones. So star that one.
So to break it down, when you're 30, one in 204 women will get breast cancer. When you're 70, it's one in four.
Wow. That's unreal.
So when a study says this doubles your risk of breast cancer, when you're 30, that impact is tiny because the risk is so small.
Right.
Whereas when you're 70, a double risk is actually one in four to one in two.
Yikes. The next category kind of puts together the estrogen exposure. So early menarche, late menopause. So, you know, people that have had early periods or late or just, exposure to estrogen. People that have not had children or have had children later or have been pregnant or been pregnant later. The absence or presence of breastfeeding. That seems to be kind of lumped together in the estrogen category. Yeah.
And using the pill.
Right.
They have a very small increase on your risk, but it is very, very small.
Okay.
And there are other things we'll talk about that have a much greater impact. And not using the pill, pregnant people can die because of pregnancy. There are unwanted abortions. Mm-hmm. You can't control when you start your period. Some women can't control when they have a family. Just ignore all of that.
Okay, good.
Ignore it all. Have children when you want them. Use the contraception method you want. Don't worry about it. There are bigger things to worry about than that when it comes to your risk of breast cancer.
Okay. The next is family and personal history chunk. So prior history of personal breast cancers or other cancers. And then next to that is family history, like you mentioned, of breast cancer, especially first degree relative at a young age.
Great question. Mm. So if you've had breast cancer in one breast, your risk of having a second breast cancer is higher. Mm-hmm. But all the treatments we give you, the hormone blockers, the chemotherapy, are reducing that risk back down to a normal person. But that's why we give you screening mammograms every year for the first 5 years, because you have an increased risk of getting a cancer in the other breast.
Got it.
So the risk is higher, but all the treatments you get reduce that risk.
I love it. The next
personal
one, I'm sorry.
The family history, only 5 to 10% of all breast cancers are due to genetics, like the BRCA gene that Angelina Jolie had. Mm-hmm. There's another couple of genes like PALB and CHEK2. There are a lot of women with a strong family cluster, and we don't know what the gene is that's causing it. But actually, most women don't have any family history when they're diagnosed. And again, you can't control that.
Yeah. The next chunk are what I would put into, like, the quote-unquote personal responsibility bucket. Your weight, your alcohol use, and having a relative paucity of regular exercise. What are your thoughts
okay.
there?
These are the three biggest risk factors that you can control that have a huge impact on your risk of breast cancer, but they're really hard to talk about. I'm going to start with alcohol. We know that if you drink more alcohol than you should, it can increase your risk of breast cancer by 10, 15, 20%, depending on how much you drink. And it's not whether you have a bottle of vodka on a Saturday night and nothing throughout the week. It's how much you drink in one period, not when you drink or what you drink. Wine is the same as spirits, it's the same as beer. Mm. This is a fact. Now, alcohol directly causes 7 cancers. It directly can cause breast cancer, but it also increases your risk of getting breast cancer because alcohol is converted to fat. And after the menopause, you convert fat produces sex hormones. So one of the biggest things you can do is to drink sensibly or ideally drink nothing. Mm-hmm. That is huge. It's really, really important. And we are seeing more and more young women. I mean, I drank like a fish at medical school. And if you told me stop drinking because it'll cause breast cancer, I'd have said, don't be silly. I'm invincible. I like my booze, you know, the nights I can't remember. But we know alcohol is a huge risk factor. The second is your weight. There is evidence to show that weighing more than you should, and it's really hard to know what to call this. Yeah. All the studies use obesity and being obese. I've asked people who are overweight and they say, just call me fat because I am.
Yeah.
Other people find that very offensive. Do you say increase body fatness? But if you weigh more than you should, that can directly cause breast cancer and increase your risk of getting it. And I think we are in an epidemic of obesity, especially in places like the States and the UK. Eating well is a privilege. You often can't afford it. Fast food is expensive. We're going to fast food because it's easy. And that has an increased risk of developing breast cancer, especially after the menopause.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you. And I think that it is a very complex issue of which we've touched on many times in this
huge,
podcast about
huge.
about how much control do we actually have over our weight. And I think the way that we frame it, and Jeremy, you can feel free to chime in here too, as far as looking at things through a weight-neutral healthcare lens is, all right, well, what are the controllables to some degree when it does come to your weight? Because so much of it does, it hinges on your genetics and things you don't have direct control over. But I think the third thing in this little chunk that I mentioned was regular exercise.
Yeah.
And I think you can control that, then maybe the weight as a symptom potentially will follow suit in some degree.
Yeah. And I think you may be genetically, you may be prone to being overweight because of your genetics and other factors. But if you are overweight, you can still choose to eat a healthy plant-based diet. So your body gets, and that's the recommendations for anyone living with cancer, because there are so many scam cancer quack diets.
Yeah.
Everyone should be eating. It's a healthy plant-based diet with a limited amount of processed food, a limited amount of sugary drinks and sweets, if you can afford to eat like that. So being overweight is one thing, but that's generally linked to people eating a very unhealthy diet. So you can eat healthy. But exercise mm-hmm. can reduce the risk of you getting cancer, not just breast, but lung and prostate and bowel, by 30 to 40%. And it can reduce the risk of a recurrence by 30 to 40%. Regular exercise 5 times a week, aerobic and weight-based. And that's huge.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, I think we oftentimes try to change the finish line here with the podcast and with when we talk to patients about their weight, that we try to focus less on what you look like and maybe even the poundage, but more so everything that else has been mentioned here, which mm-hmm. is eat a healthy diet, as you've already mentioned, exercise as much as you can and be as active. Even this... we spend a lot of time even saying the movement outside of exercise. Like if you exercise 1 hour a day, but you don't do anything else, you sit the rest of the day, that's
exactly.
not good for you. So the sedentary times to make sure you're up and moving. And then in addition to that, having your metabolic screening. So it's a very heterogeneous group, people who are put into the obesity category. And that group of people, some of them are metabolically healthy and mm-hmm. eat a good diet. And therefore their body is probably not a problem. And we can't even change their risk if we wanted to, because they can't do anything else. So, and vice versa, if you're somebody who is not getting metabolically screened and you may have diabetes or some sort of underlying thyroid problem or something that you can alter through medicine or even dietary changes, those things would have a huge effect on you. And so we focus less on like the body size and the number and more about the factors that everybody is saying when they say lose weight. When a doctor walks in the office and says lose weight, what they're telling you is everything else we just said, not look different, even though
exactly
sometimes they are telling you to look different, and that's what we're trying to change.
It's trying to be the healthiest version of yourself you can be for your given circumstances. And look, I was a slim triathlete who barely drank, and I've had breast cancer 3 times.
Yeah.
And there are people who have a very unhealthy diet, who drink and smoke, who never get cancer. So much of it is out of control.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're listening and you do drink and you are overweight and you got breast cancer, it doesn't mean they were the factors that cause it. There are mm-hmm. lots and lots of things that can make cancers happen. So it's how do you give this be healthy message without shaming people who are now blaming themselves for getting cancer. And that's not what I want to say here at all.
Yeah. The last risk factor that I found really interesting, and this actually came up when I was speaking with one of our orthopedic surgery fellows, because she had some insight and had read a paper or something about it, and it blew my hair back a bit, was, you know, the concept of exposure to ionizing radiation into the chest area. I mean, clearly, Liz, I'd like you to get your feedback on that, but it seems like anybody who's getting ionizing radiation to any area of their body may be at increased risk of cancer in that area of their body. But particularly, she mentioned that orthopedic surgeons... and other surgeons that often utilize fluoroscopy or live X-ray during their surgeries have a much higher risk of breast cancer than other physicians. And particularly, the hypothesis was that the lead screening for women was not made for women; it was made for men. So did not like the actual like lead vests or the lead aprons that you wear were not meant to block breast tissue. So I don't know if you had any thoughts about that or if that's just an urban myth.
I've not heard that. We do know if you had mantle cell radiotherapy as a child, and that's often for people with some kind of white, is it lymphoma, leukemia? I can't remember. That definitely increases your risk. Lymphoma, that's it. That definitely increases your risk and you get advanced screening. And I knew I always wear the lead, mainly protect your thyroid and mm-hmm. your ovaries. It may be a fact that orthopedic women, and there aren't a lot of female orthopedic surgeons. Mm-hmm. So that may be a fact that's coming through. And we know the lead aprons, they're not made for women. A mammogram has about the irradiation of 7 weeks of you living in your background environment from the sun and the soil. CTs are a little bit higher, and we try to do as few as possible because you know they do have increased risk. So mammograms themselves are safe, but that may be something to think about.
Yeah. Ooh. I just found that fascinating. I know. And then now that there are different lead apron choices for, you know, people that have breasts, I wonder if we're going to see that change. And I just found that very fascinating. And so thanks to Steph Bowden, fellow.
we need research in that area, definitely, because it's worrying if it's true.
Yeah.
Liz, we're about a third of the way through here, and one of the things that I was thinking coming into this podcast, and I think this isn't a good time to bring it up, is I feel like there's a huge fear of getting cancer at baseline as a human being. I feel like the fear for breast cancer is 1,000 times more than that. I think that we talk about, I mean, there's foundations, breast cancer gets a lot of attention. You've now talked about a lot of things. You've done a really good job of a couple times saying you have no control over that, forget about it. But how do we navigate this world in which women basically, from the minute they develop breasts, are fearing that they're going to get breast cancer?
Wow. I'll be honest, breast cancer wasn't on my radar because I thought I'm a breast surgeon. It's not going to happen to me. And I think if you don't know anyone who's personally had it, you're not aware of it. But social media is now full of young women with breast cancer because they're all talking about it. And it seems like it's everywhere, but it's still really rare in their 30s and 40s. It's still the old grannies getting it who aren't on Instagram and TikTok. And I think we can very easily terrify everybody into being fearful to live their life, to do anything. And that's not a healthy point to be. And it's how do we say, you shouldn't just be checking your boobs, but you should be checking your pee and your poo and your moles and giving yourself a once over just to be health aware, and then put it aside and live your life. And then once a month, come back and check. But the fear mongering is everywhere. But what annoys me, I'm going to go off breast cancer for a bit. My mum died from bone cancer. She had her arm amputated 2 years ago. And the rare cancers don't get a look in. The ovarian cancers are cervical cancers and are still killing young women. And it's how we kind of raise that awareness at school by saying cancer is something that happens to us all. And we need to be able to talk about it and not be scared of it and know what to look out for and know when to go and see our doctors. So we're a lot more au fait and it's less scary. But I don't know what the answer is. What do you guys think?
Well, my question, do you ever have people come in and say, you know, I've finished breastfeeding my children. I'd like you to just remove these. Like, I just feel like a lot of people want...
No.
No. Good. My perception as a man is that I feel like women are sitting there like, okay, I've had my usage and I'm just worried about breast cancer and I just don't want them anymore.
I've had it the other way. I've had women who've had breast cancer in one breast, one both removed to stop it coming back. And that's when you have to say, it doesn't work like that. Mm-hmm. Removing both breasts will not stop it coming back. That's like shutting the door when the horse is bolted. But I haven't seen that in the UK. But I know in the States, they'll offer double mastectomies if someone's got very mild risk of developing breast cancer, which we wouldn't do over here. I think you can be a lot more proactive, some private surgeons. And I think removing breasts is almost like mutilation. Mm-hmm. And there are complications that can happen, chronic nerve pain, seromas. It's fine if it all goes well, but if it doesn't, you're left with that. And we often send a lot of people to have some psychological counseling, especially when they've got the BRCA gene, to realize what they are actually doing. Are they prepared to be bilaterally flat for life rather than having regular screenings, just to go through the psychology of it all? Because you can make split decisions based on things happening outside your control. And we need to try and bring patients back to what it actually means to them and what are they really, really scared of.
I think socially, women are responsible for a lot of emotional labor. And so then when you're talking about a cancer specifically that... the biggest risk for having this cancer is to be a woman or to have breasts. I think it's just very clear who's probably going to be responsible for the emotional labor around this problem. And then I think that's something that is a much bigger conversation with potentially another Brit that I love, Rose Hackman, who wrote the book Emotional Labor. So, but it seems particularly interesting when you have what's considered a women's issue. And then it's like, well, handle it yourself. Handle the fear and the uncertainty and figure it out yourself.
And I think you don't know what your breasts mean to you until they have cancer.
Right.
Suddenly I felt vain wanting an implant because I wore a lot of low V-neck dresses, and how do I flirt if I don't have a cleavage? And do they define me as a sexual being? Mm-hmm. Do I need them? A lot of women who've breastfed say, yeah, take them off, I don't need them. But I've had 70-year-olds saying, what are my grandchildren going to look at when I walk around their house naked? Because my breasts are everything to me. It's that whole, does my bum look big in this? There's so much psychology. And as a breast surgeon, dealing with all of that when you're trying to make the breast look as good as you can, mm-hmm. there's an awful lot of complex psychology that goes into that doctor-patient relationship.
Certainly. I would love to move real quick, unless there's any more comments about this. But Liz, you mentioned checking your own breasts, and I would love to spend a chunk of time. So do you recommend that people examine their own breasts? How often? How do you know if you're doing it right? What are you looking for? Help me.
I'll be honest, I never check mine. And I'd love to know if the two of you check yourself regularly. You know, I didn't. It's not going to happen to me. And whenever I speak at huge healthcare organizations, the doctors in the room don't check their breasts and their testicles regularly. It's like we're invincible. My mum didn't teach me. I wasn't taught at school. I wasn't taught at university. Ideally, we should be checking them every month so you know what's normal for you, because cancers can grow between mammograms. They can just, like, if they double in size, when women are pregnant, they're flat as a pancake and then bump, the lump appears. Mm-hmm. That can happen with a breast cancer, and you need to know what's normal. And I've got a couple of videos on my channels using car wash sponges and lollipops to try and show what you're pressing down and how you do it. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of people with their arms up in the air saying, feel them like this. And that's fine if you've got small pancake flat boobs. But if you've got a boob you can hold a pencil under, mm-hmm. you need to be doing it lying down on a bed, propped up, rolled towards the middle. And I think it's really important you either get your PCP to show you how to do it.
Yeah.
Or you find a sensible doctor online so you know how to do it properly. And you know to push in with your fingers, not to prod in with the fingertips. It's really scary doing it, but there are some great things. Some Muslim communities are teaching women to do it by kneading bread. Mm. Because you don't talk about breasts in that culture, it's chest. Mm. So how can you teach people where they can't talk about breasts in public to learn how to examine them, to know what a lump feels like?
Yeah. I mean, I remember there was a very special episode of Beverly Hills 90210 when I was growing up that Brenda or somebody got, you know, felt a lump. And then there was like a whole moment of like, let's check our breasts. And I feel like there was a spike personally for me being like, yeah, I'm going to pay attention to this. And then I stopped. And I think there's also, conflicting information, kind of like going back to like, why is there such poor uptake of vaccines? And it's because when the recommendations change, then it's like, well, this is all too confusing and I'm not going to do it at all. It's like, well, you're not supposed to do it, or you are supposed to do it. What is the USPSTF telling me? Is your doctor supposed to do it for you? But I love you being very clear about this, Liz, of just saying, look, just bake it into what you're already doing on a monthly basis. First of the month, pay your rent, check your boobs.
Yeah. Ideally, if you're still having periods, you do it mid-cycle because that's when they're less lumpy.
Yeah.
But the first of the month is fine. It doesn't necessarily, our hands are quite bad at finding breast cancer. And when I went back to work after my first diagnosis, it took me 6 months to tune them in again. That's why we do ultrasounds and mammograms. But often just looking in the mirror, you'll see a little dimple or your nipples change. That could be the first early sign. You need to strip off and look first. If you can find it at an earlier stage, you'll need less treatment. You're less likely to die from breast cancer. And that's why, and now we've got stickers going up in changing rooms and we're starting to put information on bra tags just to remind people to do it.
That's smart. Marketing.
This is really great information. It's also where some of the weaknesses in the United States in terms of our larger guidance can sometimes be, like our preventative task force services, which does a great job overall. And I don't mean to throw them under the fire, but for example, testicular screening is not recommended anymore, both at home or by physicians, because we're so bad at it. But at the end of the day, I check my testicles every time I take a shower. I don't know what I would do if I had more breast tissue, meaning that I can still get breast cancer. I certainly do not check my breasts, or at least not with intent. But I don't know what I would do in that situation, because I definitely check my testicles, because that's a cancer of young people. This is not a change. That happens in younger people. And so that was always something I was deathly afraid of. And I have had two scrotal ultrasounds for things that I felt, and they were both fine. That's great. It was also an ultrasound, which is a much easier test, has no radiation, no fear of getting my testicles squeezed in between something. Another thing a man has easier than a woman in this situation, I guess, except for the fact we were already getting it younger. But it does, I think breast cancer home screening, Julie, correct me if I'm wrong, is not recommended in the United States, again, because of how many false positives there are. But at the same time, Why would you not just have everybody checking their breasts? And if they found a lump, they could go see a doctor. What's wrong with seeing a doctor? But in the United States, it's hard to see a doctor because it costs money and wait times and copays and all that other stuff.
I think I expect that 95% of the women I see in my clinic with a lump won't have breast cancer. Mm-hmm. They'll have pain or niggle, I can explain. And your hands aren't very good at picking up breast cancers, but it's all you have when you are young and you have dense breasts and mammograms don't work. And that's why it's so important that young women do it, because it is on the increase in young women.
In the interest of time, because I would like to wrap things up, Liz, by talking a bit about your podcast and some of the work that you put out on social media. And I think that'll be a nice thing to end on that won't make me cry. So I'd like to do the make me cry part first, if possible. As I alluded to in the cold open, I'd like to take a moment to recognize an unbelievable, irreplaceable human being and physician who was recently lost to very aggressive breast cancer. I want to thank the family of Dr. Kristen Abbott, including her husband Kevin and her sister Erin, for their consent in allowing me to briefly share Kristen's story and their guidance helping me tell it. Kristen Abbott was my friend and my colleague. She was a year ahead of me during our family medicine residency, and she's honestly one of the pivotal reasons that I'm here today practicing sports medicine and enjoying all the privileges and opportunities that I receive. She was a dear friend and mentor to me, but more importantly, she was a loving mother, partner, sister, daughter, friend, and a badass sports medicine physician. Kristen was an absolute rock star in the field of sports medicine, working as the head of student health at Northwestern University up until her death in January of this year. And she was very pivotal in the health of U.S. figure skating athletes, serving as team physician for that organization nationally, and then also even going to the 2022 Olympic Games in Beijing, China. She had a very brief battle with breast cancer, and without going into too much detail, this past autumn, she noticed a tender lump in her armpit. She actually had accessory breast tissue that intermittently caused her pain and discomfort since she was young, especially she was a figure skating athlete herself, so she would notice intermittent pain in this region and then, you know, kind of move on or see a doctor for it. But she noticed a painful lump in her axillary armpit region. She sought treatment. She got a mammogram that found a 6-centimeter tumor, and she was diagnosed with very high-grade, very high-stage breast cancer, which was unfortunately triple negative. And despite receiving high-quality oncology care with copious love and support from her family, her disease was very, very aggressive and ultimately became unexpectedly and very suddenly widely metastatic and ultimately ended her life this past January. Kristen is the inspiration for this episode, and she will be an inspiration for me personally for the rest of my life. I'm sure many, many others would say the same. A close friend and residency colleague of ours said, "The world needs more Kristen Abbotts," and I could not possibly agree more. She was my friend, and I loved her, and her life mattered, and her story matters, and the giant hole she leaves behind in humanity matters. And, sorry, it took me a long time to put together, and I practiced it, but it's a situation like that Dr. Reardon, like you were saying before, like there's so many people that even if they do everything right, just get dealt a bad hand, and nobody did anything wrong. She didn't do anything wrong. It's just sometimes these awful things happen, and even when you are a privileged person who has access to things, who is a physician themselves, who knows what to look for and did look for it and did get help and did get screened. And this is, you know, kind of the complete other side of things, is like sometimes just horrible shit just happens.
Yeah.
And
I hate this disease.
Yeah.
Seriously, if someone said we found a cure and you'll never need to work again, I'd give them £1 million. I hate this disease. It is so unpredictable.
Yeah.
How women with the best chance of surviving can be dead in a year, and we just don't understand it. And it's, thank you for sharing that.
Thanks.
And it may be hard for anyone listening to read, but there's so many women who don't realize breast cancer can come back. And I think it's important that you do know. You need to keep checking. You need to keep making sure that you know what your symptoms are. You know what to do if you're worried. But, oh, crikey.
And I think the onus is on us, too. Like in the beginning, in the cold open, when I was talking about what's very clearly spelled out on the USPSTF task force website, is that we're not doing a very good job in checking this in young people, and we're not doing a very good job in checking this in people of color, particularly Black women.
No.
And they're more likely to turn out to have tumors like Kristen. And so I think this is a call to action to some degree. not that what I say right now really matters all that much.
No, but it is.
Yeah.
We need equality and diversity, especially when it comes to different genders as well. Make sure that everyone can feel they can come forward, they can read, they can understand all the information out there if English is in their first language, getting rid of prejudices that any doctors may have. Mm-hmm. Black women are more likely to have triple negative breast cancer, which is more likely to kill young women. And we need to make sure they get the same standards of care that you or I would.
Yeah, absolutely.
Liz, we started this podcast a couple years ago, and I think this is the first episode we've done on breast cancer, correct, Julie?
Yeah.
But I knew that this episode would happen, and I was looking forward to asking a specific question. And so I want to ask it now because I think it applies to Kristen's story a little bit. And the question is why do you think we don't have more or better testing for younger people at this point? It feels the mammogram has been around forever, and it feels like technological advances are around us every single day. They get a lot of attention. Apple is the seventh largest economy in the world. Why don't we have anything better than the mammogram at this point?
Oh, good question. So we are seeing things come onto the market that I'm very skeptical about. Ultrasound pads that you can put on your boob to use with your phone to check your breasts. And I think that's just people making products to sell because they want to make money, not anything that's like the fitness bike that you buy that becomes a wardrobe in the bedroom. Women just need to check their breasts. I think when it comes to screening, it has to be a disease that affects a large number of the population that it's worth putting money into. And because breast cancer is still really rare in young women in the 20s and 30s and 40s, putting all that money into a huge screening program isn't worth it because the number of lives you will save is really, 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 really small. Mm-hmm. I think that's the big crux. That's why we go 50, 60, 70 where mammograms do work. We are now looking at different ways to use ultrasound, fast MRIs that take 10 minutes instead of 40 to check the women with a higher risk condensed breasts. But because it is still relatively rare, but our mind is skewed by the numbers of young women you see on Instagram and TikTok, forgetting that it's women in their 80s and 90s who are dying of breast cancer. Mm-hmm. More than the 30s and 40s. I think technology may be an answer, but it's like with mammograms, they are double read by two separate doctors at two separate times to make sure that nothing is missed. It can take you 10, 20 minutes to do an ultrasound. No one can redo those pictures. It's not accurate. And it's making sure that any new test can tick all those criteria that the screening program does. And it may be as breast cancer gets more common than there is the urge to find something. But at the moment, I think that's why it's not happened.
Yeah.
Yeah. And maybe just to follow up on that, it sounds like the mammogram is a good test in certain people.
Yeah,
so mammogram, as you get older.
Mammogram is the best test we have. It can spot tiny areas of cancer that are 2 or 3 millimeters in size. The people are pushing thermography, which is just BS. Thermography is based on infrared, saying cancers are hot, they have blood vessels, they're growing really quickly, they're really warm. Breast cancers are slow growing. And I want to pick up a breast cancer before it's even got a blood vessel, which is what mammogram can do, which is why thermographies are a waste of time and money. But they're sold as a natural alternative for 20-year-olds. Completely pointless. Not evidence tested at all.
And scary. Imagine that you get a positive result. This reminds me of like Kim Kardashian telling everybody to get a full body MRI scan.
Oh, God, don't.
All I'm going to do is have diarrhea for a year. to be worried about the nodule in my whatever, you know.
The incidental omas that now suddenly all need the testing. It's like it's the worried well with money and income to spare who are trying to make themselves as fit and healthy as possible, doing things they don't need, making people who can't afford it feel guilty. Yeah. They can't have it done as well.
Amen. Let's talk about your podcast. It's called So Now I've Got Breast Cancer, which had a previous name. And there's some parallels to our podcast. So, Jeremy, if you didn't know this, her podcast was initially called Don't Ignore the Elephant, which it sounds like it was in the beginning you were talking more about kind of all uncomfortable or lesser traveled health topics. And then you kind of honed in on specifically, let's just talk about breast cancer because I've got it. I've had it 3 times. I know how to talk about it. So can relate.
I think my journey started with a blog that led to me doing a TEDx talk, that led to me doing more blogs and writing and articles. And I think I've had breast cancer twice. My job, I'm a patient. I want to stop talking about it. I don't want to be defined by this. There has to be more outside. And I spent a lot of lockdown talking about sex and death and body issues that people don't talk about to their patients. I thought, well, okay, I can do this. And it was all right, but I realized some of the interviews are a bit flat because it wasn't a topic I was an expert in. And every day I get questions and questions from breast cancer patients. And I thought, I just need to accept this is my space. Yeah. And by answering with listeners' questions, in a podcast with an expert guest, I can reach far more people than doing a comment and a reel on Instagram. Mm-hmm. And it's just, it's another way people learn by listening or watching or reading. And it's just like another way to do. But it's hard work.
Yeah.
It is really hard work. But you must know, when you get a comment from someone saying, thank you, I listened to this and I'm now going to do that and I now understand. It's like, yeah, I've made a difference today.
Certainly. I love that. Funny connection. I was looking through your episodes and we also have an episode called What Happens When We Die. Yours featured palliative care expert Catherine Mannix, and ours featured a funeral director friend of ours and embalmer Eileen Baldischweiler. Just love making silly connections there.
Ours was very literal of like, what happens when you die? Like, where does your body
corpse.
Go?
Yeah.
No, I'm going to tell you a funny story though. This might be a bit grim for some people listening.
About
my
death.
My mum had her arm amputated. And when she died, I went to see her in the funeral home and she looked beautiful. And I went to hold her hand and I couldn't find it. What have they done? Where have the embalmers hidden? What of it was it tucked behind it? I realized she didn't have it. And I had to hold the left hand, but it was like having never been in a funeral home or seen what happens to bodies. I think it's really important that you get to know what does happen, what to expect. I'm going to listen to that episode.
It's a great one. Eileen rules. She's amazing. It's everybody wants a
little. Was that during the what the health?
Yes, this
phase
is when
too.
We were called.
We should prep.
What the health before we're your doctor friends.
I'm going to find that.
It's great. Well, yeah, I'm thinking people want to peek behind the curtain. They want people that are not going to bullshit them, that have knowledge, tell them the insider information. Like, isn't that all what we're looking for? Is just a little a little sneak peek? And that's, I think, Liz, clearly what you provide to your listeners and to people that follow you on social media. And I think you're doing a wonderful service. And the authenticity is very clearly there. And again, it's all worth it when if you have somebody that take something away and feels more empowered or feels like they empowered to appraise the medical information out there because there is a lot of really ugly, scary, not helpful things. And I mean, to bring it back to Kristen really briefly without crying, if one person hears her story and relates to it or wants to check themselves and find something or anything. Like there was a really great story about Joel Burvell. He's a medical student right now who is huge. He's called the medical mythbuster on Instagram and on everything else. And he's a third year med student. He's amazing. And he's talking about historically all of the ways that we have marginalized people of color and taken them out of the equation when we're looking at screening and looking at things. Even he had was talking about how pulse oximeters that let us know what your blood oxygen level is that you wear on your finger is not accurate for people with dark skin. And just through talking about that, there was a woman who realized this and changed something about her health. I can't remember exactly what it was, but he just posted being on Kelly Clarkson and Kelly brought out the woman who had the major change. And I was like, this is the best moment. You know, it's just, it's so great to see those things happen because you're watching physicians and healthcare providers who want to expand the sphere of influence to some degree, not because it makes us look better, we can sell things or sell books, but because it's, I don't know if we're happy doing it just, I mean, the baseline of doing like, well, I can give a talk in the community or I can talk one-on-one with a patient in the office, it just, you feel a bigger responsibility. And this scratches that itch, at least for me.
Yeah.
No. You summed it up in about 15 seconds, Liz, but I'm sure that journey for you to get to where you are now and accepting the fact that you were going to be talking about breast cancer every day and your own personal journey and struggles in addition to everybody else's was much longer than a 15-second emotional journey for you. So we're incredibly grateful for your ability to come on our show and talk about breast cancer. You hate the disease, and by hating the disease, I think you're making a huge difference in the disease. It's made a big difference for us. We were super pleased to have you on the show. I mean, it was the timing of it was we were pushed to do the show because of Kristen's situation. We talked about a breast cancer episode forever. You fit the bill perfectly for us. And when we started our podcast, what we said was we need to drown out the noise and all the bad information out there with everybody who's doing the right stuff, putting out noise. And for too long, hospital systems and doctors and medical schools and anything around a doctor said, you guys can't talk. because we are going to get sued. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or we're going to say things that are going to get us in trouble. And you know what that led to? The only people who don't have medical degrees and are not certified saying bad information. Exactly. And so we're very grateful that you're doing what you do. And whether you want to talk about it every day, please keep doing it. And if you would like to talk about a different topic, you're welcome to come on our show and talk about anything you want.
I could talk about myth. My next book's all about myth busting and diets. I think for me, it's just, if I can be honest about what it's like to be on both sides of the table, I can help people understand what breast cancer patients really need and let them know they're not alone.
Yeah.
So great.
Wonderful. Liz, any last thoughts or recommendations? I mean, other than your wonderful works, which we will link in our show notes, are there any other resources or, like, you as a breast cancer provider and survivor, any other resources that you find helpful?
Oh, so I think we are now getting more underwear for women who are flat, who have one breast and want to show it.
Nice.
Anna Ono Intimates. There are uni bras that you can just have one breast and flat sided to go wear a bikini when you're swimming, when you're on the beach, which is just fantastic. But I think for me, the exercise community is coming on board. There's going to be an International Society of Exercise Oncologists just to really push how to make you fitter to cope with treatment and reduce the risk of recurrence. And for me, it's that mindfulness. When I'm swimming in a river at 7 o'clock in the morning in January, I'm just Liz. I forget about cancer. I'm watching the birds go by. And it's that feeling of being out in nature and just trying to be healthy and connect. That's wellness to me.
I love it. Any last words, Jeremy?
I don't, although I did have dinner with my wife's boss, who's from Ireland, and she also does a lot of cold swimming. So I'm sitting here colding in a cold plunge, but you guys over there across the pond do like to seem to swim in the cold.
We do. It's amazing.
Mike Tipton, we had him on, and he's a guy from the UK, too, talking about when you mentioned that you bought a cold tub to go do it, he was like, what's wrong with you? Just go in the river. And it's like, that's over there. This is in my
Mike's
backyard.
He's at the University of Portsmouth, and he's done a lot of work on the extreme weather stuff. And he came on to talk about cold plunging because the United States we're crazy over here.
We're crazy. You just have to watch
Bad
Sisters.
I have nothing else to
add. If you're going to watch a really good UK
Bad Sisters. I've swum at the 40 Foot in Dublin. It's incredible.
Amazing. That's also an awesome show, and where a bunch of bad people get their comeuppance and a bunch of amazing Irish actors who are just great to watch and listen to and laugh. And gallows humor is the best humor in my experience.
Definitely.
Well, I would encourage any listener to check out Liz's podcast and, frankly, check out her Instagram and everything else about her because she's fantastic. So thank you for coming on the show. I have nothing else to add, Julie.
No, I love it. Well, I guess in this one, it's when it comes to breast cancer, just like anything else, try to control the controllables and just, you know, maybe listen to your doctor friends, including the breast surgeons of them.
Definitely.
The amazing music is credited to SkillCell with Pixabay licensure. The podcast is meant for educational and entertainment purposes only. The contents of this podcast should not be taken as medical advice to treat any medical condition in either yourself or others. Please consult a medical professional for any medical issues that you may be having. The contents of this podcast are the opinions of the hosts only and do not reflect the opinions of their employers or affiliations. This entire disclaimer also applies to any guests or contributors to the podcast. Under no circumstances shall Dr. Julie Bruni or Dr. Jeremy Allen or any guest to the podcast be responsible for damages arising from use of the podcast.